I'm not going to get behind the podium with such a small group. I'll just stand right here. And my favorite, I could even sit, but I can't talk if I'm not moving. That's the. Someone said, "Are you Italian?" I said, "No, but I'm married to someone who's Italian. And I grew up on Long Island, so all my friends were either Italian, Roman Catholics, or Jewish. So I picked up on some of the mannerisms, I suppose. So thanks a lot for coming again. Really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to this time. I love to preach, but my bread and butter is teaching. Some of you have asked me what it is I do and where my church is. I should have introduced myself a little bit more. Sorry about that. But I teach theology at Austin Seminary. To people who are going to become ministers. And I love to think about theology, so my specialty is thinking about Christian doctrines and what they have to do with each other and what they have to do with real life. And so I think that people who are theologians, like myself, also should be preaching and in the church a lot, because then you bring back what you learn from the church into the classroom, and hopefully you bring what you're teaching in the classroom into sermons, into the community, so there's, cross conversation. So I see my calling as kind of being a joiner of seminaries and churches. I don't buy the idea professors should be sort of in an ivory tower somewhere, but I also don't buy the idea that we need to check our brains at the door as people of faith. And one thing I value about this community already, having been here two whole days, is I can tell this is a community where people are using their minds and their hearts, and it's not a kind of either or, but they're hot-wired to each other, minds and hearts. So I'm hoping this class now can show that off, and feel free to just interrupt me, and it won't throw me off. If it is gonna throw me off, I'll ask you to just wait a minute while I finish some thought. But please do throw out whatever you'd like to say. I thought that was a great summary of what I was trying to get at last night. I think there really, there is a place for engaging in some of the so-called more intellectual arguments, maybe even for what we call in theology apologetics, making a case. But finally, and I think those Bible studies that I led, they were oriented that way when I was in college. So that friend I had who wasn't a professing Christian who came to the Bible studies really thought that was all very interesting. But what she saw in the course of that is that that's not really finally what was most meaningful to me. And she needed me to just tell her, this has changed me. And I believe that it could change you, and it can change the world. And then you're in a situation where you're not over, like you just said, over and against someone else saying, I'm more pious, or I'm more righteous, or I'm less sinful, or I glow because this little light of mine. I mean, the point isn't to be self-directed, like I was saying last night, but to be, D.T. Niles once said, he was a great missiologist, he said, as Christians, we are beggars telling other beggars where to find bread. Beggars telling other beggars where to find bread. So it's sharing that news about where the bread is found.
And a really good word for it.
Yeah.
I think winsome.
Yeah, winsome. Yes. Yes. It's so funny you say that. I'll have to bring this back to Austin Seminary where I teach, because winsome is in our mission statement. And it's kind of a big joke that we're a winsome community, but every time we revise the statement, we keep it because of this. Winsome has a kind of sense of beauty, but also humility. We're appealing. So it's less of I'm better than you as an invitation in to be in relationship too. And so I think a lot about how do we as Christians in the world extend our arms and say, we're in it together with you. But let's, we found some bread every now and then. And some days we have a better sense, don't we, of where the bread is than others. Sometimes I forget where the bread is. As a Christian, it's not like every day I remember, and then you have to remind me, right? You have to remind me. And frankly, I think sometimes even the so-called nuns can show me something, too, about what it is I need to be looking for and where the bread is. So it's less about an us-them. We've got it and they don't. We have something to offer. I think that's where the nuns are saying, we're kind of tired of this, right? We're kind of tired of this hypocrisy. Why don't you just admit, we're in it together? And I think we can do that. I think we do it, and we just need to do it more consistently, more loudly. Now, the Tebow thing, I'm with you. I actually think one should err on the side of being gracious, grace, graciousness, and say, yeah, here's a guy who's, I mean, he's really trying to be consistent with who he is. No, I don't know. I don't know. It's funny. I write for the Dallas Morning News, in something called the Texas Faith Blog, and they ask me all these questions all the time, political questions. But sometimes they ask me to write whole articles, and for the life of me, I can't figure out why they ask me to write about athletes, because I really am not good in that arena. I have to ask. Who's that person they're asking me to write about? I ask my husband, who's a big football fan and a basketball player. But the other one they asked me to write on was Lance Armstrong. And they said, I wrote an article on, is there hope for Lance Armstrong? Right after he, did he confess? I don't even remember. He confessed. And, you know, a theologian and person of faith we have to say yes to that. Right? Is there hope? Now, we might go, oh, it doesn't feel like there's hope. I don't think there's hope. But it's sort of in the job description, not to lie, but to say, all right, Lord, I believe, help me now my unbelief. Yes, there's hope. And then you say, all right, there's hope. What does it look like? Right? And that's what we confess. There's hope. What does it look like? There's eternal life. Okay? God is in control. I mean, a couple weeks ago with Charleston, you went, okay, God is in control. How exactly is that the case? You know. So I wrote, sure, there's hope. And I wrote about the Armstrong Foundation, and I wrote about the fact that he confessed. But I got more hate mail over that article than any other anything else I've ever written in my life. More hate mail. It was kind of scary, actually, because it was on the blog, but then people can just look up my name and find my address and find where I work. So I'm getting these letters saying, from Christians, saying, you know, this is a problem. You're the kind of theologian we don't need. You're the problem with the church today. You have to remember God's a God of judgment. And I mean, there were lines in these letters that said things like, Lance Armstrong will burn in hell. You know, and I don't think he will. I don't believe he will. I don't get to decide. This is the thing, not in my job description, right? This is God's job description. Yeah, who's in and who's out? Not up to me. Weed and tares, not up to me. But yeah, this harshness I kind of saw in the letters. And I know it's the crazy people who wrote the letters, but there were too many of them to ignore. It wasn't just one. So there's a resistance to, this is my segue now, thanks, into grace. But when we start really thinking about hope and its power, and thinking about grace and its power, there's a kind of resistance to it, because let's face it, there's something very impractical about grace, right? Something very impractical about forgiving, which is related. Something really impractical about unconditional love. Let me fill this out a little and do a little mini sermon. Think of the parable of the prodigal son. Okay, everybody knows this parable, Luke chapter 15. You got the father, you got the prodigal son who goes out, you have the elder son who says, this son of yours comes home and you give him a party and you've never given me a party and I've always done everything right. Remember that part? Well, you know what? Reading that story at face value, the elder son is completely right. He has. Everything the father has asked of him, he has done. If anyone in that story deserves a party, it's the elder son. I mean, what's the father doing? Giving the prodigal son a party. If I were the minister, the pastor of the father, I would send him to a good therapist, because his kids are walking all over him, right? I mean, what's that? Yes, we had to rejoice. We had to rejoice, the father says, for this son of mine was lost and now is found, right? He's come home again, yeah. And the elder son makes the good point, but why throw him a party? See, you know, it would have made sense from the standards of maybe the people who wrote me those letters, right? But maybe even people who wouldn't write the letters but are just thinking, I don't know. You know, there's a price to be paid. Yeah, what about mercy? What about grace? It would have made sense, see, if the father were sitting in his kitchen waiting for the prodigal to come home. You know, I've got an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. and I can see the day coming. I think it's in about next week, when I'm when I'm waiting, looking out the window, you know, and you're waiting to see if they come. Because we let our son, who's 11 and a half, go on his first bike ride with a friend, like around in the neighborhood, like without us, a couple weeks ago. I couldn't concentrate till he was home. You know, every 2 minutes I walked to the front door, I looked out to see if I could see him, you know. So you see this father watching for his adult son, watching for his adult son, watching for that beloved head on the horizon, the head of the child who he kissed, who he blessed, to come up and come around. He's watching that son, and he sees him. But you know what? If the father had any sense at all, right, any even health and boundaries at all, he would have said, all right, here he comes. He would have sat down in that kitchen, you know, put on his glasses, picked up his New York Times, cup of coffee, read it, and when he heard that knock on the door, he might have gone over and said, who is it? Dad, it's me. Might have cracked that door and said, what do you have to say for yourself? Now let me tell you something, that father, we would have commended him for being gracious, opening the door at all. What do you have to say? That father would have waited on the speech. Father, I've sinned against heaven and earth, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Take me on as one of your hired hands. Father would have waited and said, you really mean that, son? I'm not sure you mean it. Say it again. Right? And maybe over time, he would have let the son in, sit at the table for a while. If he was really nice, really kind, more kind than he needed to be, given what the son had done to him, maybe he'd make his son a peanut butter sandwich, no jelly, too much, right? And giving it to him. So we're going to see how it goes. Just going to see how it goes. You need to watch your step. Now that would sort of make sense. That would be as much as maybe the son should hope for. Maybe that's all he was hoping for, coming back. But that father, it's embarrassing. What the father does is utterly embarrassing. He sees that son at the window, throws down whatever he's cooking, whatever spatula he has in his hand, whatever newspaper he's been reading, and runs out vulnerably to this son, showing full of emotion. You know, it doesn't even matter that the son had this speech prepared. We don't know. You talk about not being able to make a judgment. We don't know if the son was truly repentant or if he was just really hungry and coming up with a good strategy. Father, I've sinned against heaven and earth. I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Take me on as one of your hired hands. Good speech, right? Well, what we do know is the father didn't even hear the speech. The father has that son in an embrace. This son of mine was lost and is found. He's come home again. Embraces him, calling for the party, putting a cloak around him, putting a ring on his finger, saying, come on, let's celebrate. Let's rejoice. Like I said, bad boundaries. Grace is a wonderful thing. It's no way to run a corporation, no way to run a world. Who do you reward? You reward the person who's always done what's right, right? You might, in your kindness, give a prodigal a second chance, but you don't give him everything. You don't kill the fatted calf. What am I trying to get at? This grace stuff, this love stuff, this unconditional love is outlandish. It's extravagant. You know what it is? It's prodigal. Because as it turns out, the word prodigal means excessive. I always thought it meant bad, the prodigal son and the bad son. It means the excessive son. So the prodigal's excessive because he spends all the money. But guess who the most excessive person is in the parable in Luke 15? The father. Prodigal love. Guess who's the most excessive of all? Our God on that cross. Prodigal. Holding nothing back, giving it all. We say it in the Apostles' Creed that probably all of us in the room share as Christians, regardless of what denomination or background we come from. We say, born of the Virgin Mary, right? Incredible, incredible idea. We get all hung up on whether that means Mary didn't have sex, and how could that be scientifically? We're back to the sort of, can we make a rational argument for that? And we miss the bigger picture. You realize what that creed says is that our God in Jesus Christ entered into the womb of a human being, a woman, all the way in. It's excessive. But God is omnipotent, omnipresent, immutable, impassible. What would God be doing in a uterus? Believe it or not, this is a very, very relevant idea. For centuries, Christians resisted born of the Virgin Mary. You know why? Not because of sex or no sex for getting pregnant. That wasn't the issue. It was, how could the perfect God who created all of this, how could that God go there? Right? It wasn't really a popular place for God to go. Right? It's excessive. God's entry into existence with us, into our bones, into our flesh, is excessive. Born of the Virgin Mary. Irenaeus in the second century, a theologian, put the words of Adam to Eve in the mouth of Jesus. He said, in that incarnation, born of the Virgin Mary, that excess, that entering all the way in, that holding nothing back. He put the words of Adam to Eve in Jesus' mouth. Jesus says to us, you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Jesus Christ enters into our bones, into our flesh, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, enters even into death. Jesus would have been perfectly within bounds to have better boundaries and say, you know what? I came all the way down here, born of the Virgin Mary. I sat in the corner of that carpenter shop watching Joseph cut those boards for years as a child. He cut them wrong half the time for Mary's bookshelf, and I couldn't say anything. I didn't say anything. I grew up. I ate with tax collectors and sinners. I taught about God's love. I really went further than I needed to go, Jesus could have said, but this is too far. Matthew even says he could have called 10,000 angels to destroy the world and set him free. Okay? But he didn't. He held nothing back. Excessive. Prodigal. See, our understanding of grace begins and ends with this event of Jesus Christ, God pouring God's whole self out, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, crucified, dead, and buried. What? This one without whom nothing was made that was made, John chapter 1, was born of the Virgin Mary, suffered, crucified, dead, and buried. And some of us, including we Presbyterians, who are right about this, incidentally, also include in the creed, he descended into hell, which I see as covering all our bases. Just in case you think there is a place that cannot be redeemed, an experience that cannot be covered, an experience that is absent the unconditional love of God, a space where someone cannot be saved. Think again, why? Because this one who held nothing back entered not only into a womb, not only into death, but even into the abyss, even into Sheol, even into hell. How can that be? I don't know, you know? I don't know, but what does it mean? Now, lots of things we can't understand. In fact, St. Augustine in the 5th century said this. He said, if we have understood, what we have understood is not God. And to quote another great theologian, Madeleine L'Engle. Have you ever read Madeleine L'Engle? In her book, she wrote A Wrinkle in Time. Well, she tells this story in Walking on Water. She said she had to go to a school assembly and talk about what it was like to be a writer. She wasn't very prepared. She thought it's just a bunch of kids, you know. It won't be hard. How hard could it be? It's a bunch of kids. You know, I have teachers in the room. So she walks into this assembly room, and there are 600 elementary school kids, rabble-rousing in there. And she, in desperation, feeling around for how to start her talk, said, how many of you have ever read A Wrinkle in Time? And a couple fifth grade girls, thank goodness, in the front row, you know the type, goody two shoes, straight A students, smiling, raise their hands. And she says, oh, good. Did you understand it? And one of the girls thought for a minute and said, well, I didn't understand it, but I knew what it was about. Madeleine L'Engle says, or maybe I'm saying this, I can't remember this transition. I read that and I said, this is how to do theology. Do I understand born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, crucified, dead, and buried, prodigal love, prodigal grace, descended into hell? Do I understand how it is that God held nothing back and entered even into the place that God is not? No. But what is it about? It's our hope, see? Nothing is unredeemed. There's no space. Even the space of God's absence, where God is not present. Like I said, do I understand that? No, but I know what it's about. I got to tell one more story about that. As my dad, who I've told a few of you used to be a fundamentalist Baptist minister, but now he's made the decision to become one of the elect, so he's Presbyterian now. So thank you for those of you who understand that Presbyterian joke. But anyway, back then, my dad, incredible man of faith, took the train from Long Island into Manhattan to the church that he served every day. And, you know, we'd wait for him. We'd pick him up at the Babylon train station, for those of you who know New York. We'd bring him there, pick him up. And so Dad comes home, and he's got to be the most jovial person on the planet. He's annoyingly happy, my father, all the time. And he's always singing and has this big baritone voice. And he comes home, and he is upset. He's sad. And I said, Dad, what's going on? I was a teenager. And he told me, he said, well, John killed himself today. Well, John was this guy from the church, Calvary Baptist Church, who had been depressed. My dad was talking to him, counseling him. And one day he just succumbed, and he jumped in the subway tracks and killed himself, committed suicide. And the policy of the church at the time, I'm not sure what the policy is now, but it was that you can't have a funeral. You can't have a service of witness to the resurrection, a funeral, for somebody who commits suicide, because they had decided suicide is out of bounds. It's not possible for someone who's a genuine Christian to go that far. If you're a genuine Christian, you don't commit suicide. And my dad knew John, and he knew he didn't get to decide, but he certainly didn't think... He wasn't without hope for John. He didn't think that John was relegated to hell because he had committed suicide, because he knew John. So he sat at that kitchen table. I'll never forget it. I must have been about 15 or 16. My dad sat with his big Scofield reference King James Bible, right? Because if it's good enough for Jesus and Paul, it's good enough for us, right? Remember the King, at the kitchen table, thumbing through this Bible, trying to think of what kind of case he could make to the session to allow him to have the funeral for John. Finally, I went to bed. I come down the next morning. There's my dad. He always had on a three-piece suit. My dad, I can just see it, sit him, just sitting in the living room with his smile back on his face, his briefcase, you know. He's ready to go to the train station to go into work. And I said, Dad, what happened? He said, I figured it out. I'll tell you when I get home. He came back, the smile was still on his face. And he told me, he said, you know, I couldn't really make an argument from the Bible. I mean, I'm sure he could have. But he said, what really clicked, he was trying to find something he could really, just with a little punch. He said, it's that Apostles' Creed. He descended into hell. Right? Jesus went into hell. Jesus went into the darkest places. No place is unredeemable. God's grace is sufficient. God's love is there, right? The hell, the space, the abyss, suicide, we can't say it's not redeemed. And the elders allowed him to have the funeral in the church. So he descended into hell. Why does it matter? Well, it mattered because you could have the funeral for John at Calvary Baptist Church. He descended into hell. Well, look, this is just your introduction. If you look at your chart, I want to talk a little bit about the chart in relation to this. But where we're thinking now is starting out thinking about the parable of the prodigal son, so-called, talking about the prodigal, extravagant love of the father. I got to just finish that thought off, and then we'll enter into the chart. Is the father comes in, and the elder son gives his spiel, right? And I think you probably remember, but in case you don't, he says, Dad, I have done everything you've ever wanted me to do, and you've never given me a party for me and my friends. And this son of yours comes home, and you give him this party. And then we're waiting for the father's response, you know? And it's just a kind of crazy response, because the father doesn't really address what the elder son brings up. You know what his response is? He says, my son, I am always with you and you are always with me. And then he says, you know, you have the Bible memorized, doesn't he? He's one of these people. It's great. All that is mine is yours. Some translations say, don't you realize that everything I have is yours? There it is, boy. If you take anything away from this morning, that verse God saying to us, don't you realize that everything I have is yours? What would happen if we realized that? What if we realized everything God has is ours? We'd be able to be graceful to others, because it wouldn't be about making sure we got our fair share. We already have everything. May as well invite everybody else in to share it. See, it's a very different idea than what we hear in stewardship campaigns. You know, easy for me to say as a professor, since I don't have to run too many stewards, but we hear, you know, everything we have is God's, so the least we could do is give back 10%, right? Well, that's not true, but I just start thinking, well, what would happen if we thought about it in reverse? Not everything we have is God's, but everything God has is ours. Then what you're giving to God isn't away from yourself, because everything you have already belongs to God. You're actually part of the same household. It's not that God is here and we're over here and we have all this stuff that we've taken from the household and then we're returning to the household. It puts a distance between us and God that's there in the conversation between the elder son and the father in Luke 15. But that the father doesn't have in mind at all. Don't you realize everything I have is yours? We're in a household. We're a family. It's the same spirit in which he said, my son was lost and is found again. He's back in the household. We have these things in common, right? Everything I have is his. Everything I have is yours. And, you know, to the father's credit again, it's amazing. He's so joyful, so caught up in his joy about the son returning. He goes into the party. But you know what? He looks around and he says, someone's not here who needs to be here. And he leaves the party to go out and get the elder son. The elder son then is the outsider that he has to bring in. Don't you realize? Don't you realize? Everything I have is yours. What if we realize that? Now, just a little more on this, I can't resist saying, but commentaries throughout the ages have really gotten stuck trying to figure out the father's response to the elder son. So I sound a little bit judgy on this one. I'm just trying to stay on the line. But I think I've given a good, pretty good answer to how to interpret this. But what I find to be interesting is that many commentators will say this. They'll say, well, that elder son was completely out of line. He didn't understand New Testament inheritance law. And then there'll be six pages about New Testament inheritance law and about how technically the elder son didn't inherit his share of the property until the point of the father's death, and unless the father made a special concession, as he did in the case of the younger son, who was within his rights technically use up his half of the inheritance, but the elder son hadn't requested the inheritance yet. So the calf that the father killed for the party for the younger son was the father's property, therefore the elder son. You see how, you know, boring this all gets? As if this is the point of the text, right? All that I have is yours. The father couldn't care less about New Testament inheritance laws. The father doesn't care about these things. The father cares about the household. The son is right. The elder son is right. In the order of law, in the order even of justice, of exchange, of annual reviews, if you have to do those in the workplace, you have to do annual reviews, that's what we call them, annual evaluations, right? In corporations, we do them in seminaries, right? Right? This is how it works. These are the rules. How well have you done? How poorly have you done? How are you going to improve next year, right? The elder son is right in the game. He's the person you want to hire, the elder son, not the younger son. By the way, not any of the disciples either. Kind of want to hire Nicodemus. He'd be a good, you know what I'm saying? Nicodemus is, you know, it's logical, right? He does, he shows up and he does. Anyway, this isn't how our God operates. We were talking last night about foolishness. There's a foolishness attached to grace. Grace is not just kindness. It's something else. It's something inexplicable and sometimes annoying, particularly when you're trying to run an operation. So the elder son is right in the order of law, and the father says, give that up and come in with me to the order of grace. Not very logical, not very workable. You know, grace didn't start, obviously, either with the story of the prodigal son. I see it way back in Genesis chapter 15, for example. So this is the story of God calling Abraham out to look at the stars. So here's Abraham, you know, and Abraham doesn't have any children. And we think he was about 100. Who knows about these things? I don't understand them, but I know what they're about. He was too old to be having children. That's what it's about. Sarah, too old to be having children. God calls him out, and he says, look up at the sky, God says. And Abraham looks up and can't see anything. It's pitch black. And God says, all right, click your heels 3 times, squint your eyes, and you might be able to make out a star or two. So hold on to hope. No, God doesn't say that, because God's love, God's grace, God's promises aren't about squinting and holding out for a little something. God's promises are prodigal, super abundant, overflowing. So Abraham looks up and there's a sky full of stars, a sky full. And God says, so shall your descendants be. Now let me tell you something. This is insanity, right? I mean, Abraham, we would expect to be a little like Moses. Oh, God, you know, well, that's kind of a good plan, maybe, but the problem is I stutter. Can we send in, you know, someone to help me out? And I, you know, what's your name again that I can tell the Pharaoh? I mean, Moses, you know, Abraham doesn't back off like that. Abraham's kind of like Mary, right? Let it be unto me as you have said. When she's shown a sky full of stars, Abraham believes God and it's reckoned to him as righteousness. You know, Don Quixote, Cervantes, right? If you know this great literature, it's modeled off of Abraham being crazy enough to hope about for that which is outlandish, a wallet full of grandbaby pictures, not just one or two, not just a little something, but a wallet full. Man of La Mancha is modeled off of Don Quixote, right? Modeled off of Abraham to dream the impossible dream, right? Not the highly unlikely, but possible if you keep on trying. Do your best and God will take care of the rest. Pull yourself up from your bootstraps. Give it your best effort and God'll help us muddle through. No, right? Man of La Mancha, Don Quixote. Right? Is that what he's called in Man of La Mancha? Is it Don Quixote? Everybody thinks he's crazy, right? Remember his daughter-in-law? I'm only thinking of him. She's trying to get him committed to an insane asylum. You know why? His hope is too great. He believes too much in the impossible things. Okay, here we go. We are called as people who believe we're saved by grace alone, as people who proclaim God's unconditional love, to be that kind of crazy, right? Not just to think, well, God will give us a little more than we deserve, right? I can give you a little more than you deserve. I bet you would give me a little more than I deserve too. People around here are really kind, right? I mean, God isn't just giving us a little more than that. God's giving us all that God has, right? A sky full of stars. Yeah, I have days where I find this hard to believe. And then I have to go back to Abraham, go back to Mary, go back to Christ, go back to what this is all about and say, all right, this stuff is excessive. Grace is excessive. Right? It's not just a supersized box of kindness that God is selling us. It's all that God has. It's completely other. You know how we talk about God's kingdom is not this world tweaked and improved? You know how we talk about us not only being new and improved in Christ, right? To be a Christian is to be a new and improved model of a human being, right? What we say is all things pass away and the new comes. We're made into new creations. We sing about it. Spirit of the living God, fall afresh on me, right? Then we sing what? Melt me. Really? You want to be melted? Really? Melted? Seriously? Melted? Are we ready for melted? I don't know. Mold me. Molded. Melted and molded. You ready to be melted and molded? Fill me. Use me. We like that because we're kind of intact. We can be filled and used. Yes. New and improved and effective and successful. But melted and molded and changed. We sing it like we mean it. But yeah, grace, you start really living into this super abundance You start realizing everything God has is yours, which, by the way, means you go into that party and you begin to be changed by it in the way you think. You start thinking in the order of grace and not in the order of law, and that can really wreck with certain ways of participating in systems that are about getting what you deserve. Is this making sense? I mean, I'm really trying to